I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Still to come, are you carrying a human rights violation in your pocket? Now that people are becoming more aware of the conditions inside some of the factories where these products are made, some activists are saying it's time for consumers to step up and demand changes. A reporter who's been covering this will tell you more about this controversy in a few minutes. That's just ahead. But first, we want to turn to the Middle East, where American officials are watching events closely in a number of countries.
We have concluded that we need to suspend operations at our embassy in Damascus in light of the fact that we have security concerns about the safety of our personnel.
That is State Department spokeswoman Victoria Nuland announcing that the U.S. is pulling staff out of its embassy in the Syrian capital, Damascus. There have been ongoing reports that dozens of people are being killed every day by government forces there. Meanwhile, in Egypt, 19 Americans have been accused by the military government of working to undermine that regime. Sam LaHood, who is the son of U.S. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood, is among those who have been banned from leaving the country. And President Barack Obama yesterday announced a new series of sanctions against Iran. We wanted to take a closer look at all of these stories, so we've called upon Hisham Melham. He is the Washington bureau chief for the television station Al Arabiya, and he joins us from time to time to talk about events in the region. Welcome back. Thank you so much for joining
us.
We want to get to the other stories in a minute, but we'd like to start with Egypt, because obviously this is a story of great concern,
sure,
particularly to Americans. We're coming up on the anniversary of Hosni Mubarak's ouster, but now the military government, who has been essentially running the country in this interim period before there have been elections, says that 19 Americans are going to stand trial for illegally funding anti-government groups. And as we mentioned, one of the Americans is the son of a cabinet member. And I'd like to ask you, what do you think is behind this? And what do you think the implications are for Egypt's relationship with the U.S.?
The American-Egyptian relationship is going to go through a different period. It's not going to be, again, the kind of strategic partnership that was built 3 decades ago to stand up to the Soviet Union, to get the Soviets out of Afghanistan, to work on the peace process, to collaborate politically on regional issues. Now you have a very precarious transition going on in Egypt, supervised by this unelected body, which is called SCAF, Supreme Council for the Armed Forces of Egypt, which ruling Egypt by decrees. They sense that there is latent anti-Americanism there, and they feel that by subjecting these 19 Americans to this kind of public charade plays into the streets. And there is a Minister of International Cooperation. She's known for her anti-American views, and she believes that, you know, playing the American boogeyman helps the SCAF. She's very close to the SCAF, Field Marshal Tantawi, who's the head of the military council. So, but essentially what we have now is a military government that is looking for enemies abroad and domestic to justify its presence. They know that the new parliament doesn't want them to remain in power, but they want to enter into a new arrangement whereby the new order in Egypt, whatever that order is, will maintain their economic perks and their special political status.
You know, what's interesting about this is the U.S., as you would imagine, is now threatening to withhold over $1 billion in aid to Egypt. And it has to be known, at least by the military government, that a very large percentage of that funding does go to the military. So it just seems curious that they would take this step, which would jeopardize a lot of their funding.
Absolutely. But there is a kind of maybe naive notion on the part of the military council in Egypt that the Americans want that relationship, that the Americans are not going, at the end of the day, cut off military aid or economic aid. But I'll tell you, I'm sensing a chorus of voices in this town calling for the United States to, if not cut off aid completely, but to reduce it. And there are many experts who argue that we should reach that point, that we've been supplying Egypt with economic aid and military aid, just as Israel, you know, since the 1979 peace agreement. And I think those two countries, to put it bluntly, don't need that kind of support.
Israel and Egypt are the largest recipients of U.S. government aid still. So I'm going to ask you, what scenario do you see unfolding here?
I think for sure, with certainty, we can say that the Egyptian-American relationship is no longer the same. And you're going to see more criticism on the part of the Egyptians of the United States government, because they believe that this play well with the street, with the new majority, the Islamist majority, the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Salafis in the new parliament. And I think it's about time that the relationship will be normalized. this is no longer a very special relationship.
I do have to ask just briefly before we move on, because we do have other countries we wanted to check in on. Is there any substance to the charges as you understand it? Or you use the word charade. Is there any substance to what the accusations are? And do you really think that these trials will go forward?
Look, the Americans, and I think correctly, the American government correctly insists that some of the money that goes to Egypt goes to NGOs. The Egyptian government under Mubarak always undermined NGOs. They wanted the American money to go directly to them. But every time an American supports NGOs in Egypt, they talk about interference, undermining Egyptian sovereignty, interfering in Egypt's domestic affairs. They cannot have it both ways.
We're talking about developments across the Middle East with Al Arabiya Washington Bureau Chief Hisham Melham. He's here in our Washington, D.C. studios. Let's head to Syria now. The U.S. has evacuated all embassy personnel out of the country, as we said. You know, we've been hearing reports all along for months now of major attacks against anti-government groups and other civilians. Hard to verify because very hard for Westerners to report in that country. Now, the U.S. is saying that the president's, Bashar al-Assad's, time is running out. Do you think that that's really true?
I think it is true. It's a question of time. I think he is, as one American official said, a dead man walking. It's a question of time when he will be overthrown. And I shudder to think about the price that the Syrian people are going to pay and are paying every day. There are some reporters in Homs, which is the third largest city that is getting the brunt of the attacks from the government forces. And we've seen indiscriminate shelling against civilian neighborhoods. And this can be basically verified, I mean, by reporters, by eyewitnesses, by YouTube videos, and we've seen all of that. There's war being waged on the people of Homs in particular. And if you remember, this uprising began as a peaceful movement, and it remained largely a peaceful movement. Then you had defections from the army, and now those who are fighting the conventional forces, the government forces, are defectors from the army who are sick and tired of shooting at their own people. And now you have a qualitative shift in the government's attacks after the Russian-Chinese veto over the weekend, which was seen by many people in the Arab world and in the world, really, as a new license to kill given by the Chinese and the Russians to the Syrian regime of Bashar al-Assad.
Just to clarify here that there was an attempt made to get the United Nations Security Council to coalesce around an effort in Syria and Russia and
China. An effort supported by the Arab League and the Europeans and the Americans. It was not Western-imposed, as some people, as the regime is claiming. It's essentially an Arab peace plan.
An Arab peace plan which Russia and China opposed.
Right.
So the question I think that many people have, and you covered the NATO operation that helped oust Muammar Gaddafi from Libya. Why has there not been an effective international intervention in Syria to this point, as we have seen in other places when the international community came to a decision, as was the case in Libya? Why do you think that hasn't happened in Syria?
Well, it was a lot easier to use military force against Libya. What happened in Libya remained in Libya. Unfortunately, what happens in Syria does not remain in Syria. Syria is surrounded by a number of states that are extremely important for the United States. Tension in Syria is likely to spill over to other countries, Iraq, Turkey, Lebanon, maybe even Jordan. Syria has a stronger military. So unless you have a concerted American effort or led by the United States, nobody is talking about a serious military intervention. And this country is not willing at this stage, for a variety of domestic reasons, Afghanistan, you name it, is not willing to play that important role. And that's why they are trying to focus their collaborations with the Turks, with the Arabs and the Europeans to squeeze the regime, to deprive the regime from sources of funding, but short of a military intervention a la Libya.
Finally, and all of these stories are complicated and deserve time and attention, we do want to spend the last couple of minutes talking about Iran. The U.S. just announced a fresh round of sanctions against banking institutions in Iran, and there have been open rumblings about an Israeli strike against Iranian nuclear facilities. Could you talk a little bit about why now? Why is this happening now?
This administration is very concerned that the Israelis may take things into their own hands and attack Iran during the presidential campaign, the last year of a president in office. And that's the last thing the United States would like to see now, at a time when it's still involved in Afghanistan, at a time when the economic recovery is still slow. An attack on Iran will create havoc in the oil markets, international markets. It will allow the Iranians, give them an excuse to lash out at the Americans in Iraq and in Afghanistan and the Gulf. And this is precisely what Barack Obama, President Obama, said on Sunday. So essentially, the United States is very concerned about the unilateral Israeli attack. On the other hand, the American intelligence services, and I think most intelligence services in the world, tell you that Iran is not there yet in terms of producing all the components of a nuclear device. And that's why the administration, on the one hand, is ratcheting up the pressure and maybe attempts to sabotage the nuclear program from, you know, from the outside, short of a military option at this stage. And by the way, this president, Barack Obama, has imposed the most stringent sanctions on the Iranian regime more than any previous president, with collaboration with the Europeans. Today, the Iranians are really beginning to feel the economic and financial pinch.
Finally, before we let you go, we've focused on these stories which are commanding the headlines, you know, for obvious reasons. Is there another story from the region that you think we should be paying attention to that perhaps is not getting as much attention that your reporters, for example, are talking about?
Well, I mean, the Palestine issue remains an issue. And then you have the other uprisings taking place in the Arab world, like in Bahrain. We don't talk too much about the Bahrain because we have a major naval base there. Also, Yemen, it's still in ferment. But essentially, the region is going through a tremendous social and economic and cultural changes. And then the Islamists are going to inherit the immediate future of most of these societies. And it's going to be a debate within the Muslim groups as to the nature of governance, as to the nature of these societies in the next decade or two. And this is a long-term story that is extremely complex, even for those of us who make a living covering that part of the world.
Well, thank you for taking the time to
thank
talk
you.
About this with us. Hisham Melham is the Washington Bureau Chief for Al Arabiya Television, and he was kind enough to join us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, that smartphone that helps you find everything from the soccer field to the title of that catchy song comes with a big price tag. And now, some serious questions for smartphone makers like Apple.
It's a question of how much Apple wants to be involved in the manufacture of the products that they are paying for. And what people are saying is that Apple is not involved enough.
Can you satisfy your thirst for a new phone and your ethics at the same time? We'll find out. That's coming up next on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, there are millions of dollars in financial aid available to college students, but many of the people who need it most are intimidated by the process of applying for it. Sound familiar to anybody? I thought so. There are several efforts underway to guide parents and students through the paperwork. We'll tell you about one of them in a few minutes. But first, we'd like to ask if there is a human rights crisis hiding in your pocket or perhaps your purse. There's been a lot of coverage lately about the treatment of workers at Chinese factories that help make Apple products. And recently, the public radio program This American Life aired a version of Mike Daisy's one-man show, The Agony and Ecstasy of Steve Jobs. At one point, he talks about a trip he took to China to a factory called Foxconn to see where and how his Apple products are made. Here's a short clip from that piece.
The official workday in China is 8 hours long. That's a joke. I never met anyone who'd even heard of an 8-hour shift. Everyone I talked to worked 12-hour shifts, standard, and often much longer than that. While I'm in country, a worker at Foxconn dies after working a 34-hour shift. I wish I could say that's exceptional, but it's happened before. I only mention it because it actually happened while I was there.
The New York Times recently published a series detailing labor problems being tied to companies that help make Apple products. One article describes factory explosions, the use of toxic chemicals, and crowded and unsanitary living conditions for workers. We were wondering what it would take for products like smartphones to be produced in a more ethical fashion. So we've called up CNET editor Rafe Needleman, and he's with us now. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
First, could we just clarify what we're talking about here? Are the factories that we're talking about owned by Apple?
No, they're not. Apple outsources its manufacture of its iPhones and iPads to a company called Foxconn in China. Foxconn makes electronics for many companies, and there are a lot of companies like Foxconn in China where all of our small electronic devices are made.
So there's nothing distinctive about the conditions that characterize the factories where Apple products specifically are made? Is it just that Apple is the best known and the most famous?
Apple has a unique position because of its scale and its design influence. It does push the way they're manufactured, but the concept of the mega factory being staffed by thousands, tens of thousands of workers is not unique to Apple.
But Apple has felt a need to respond to these articles and to this reporting. What are they saying?
Yeah, Apple CEO Tim Cook has said in a memo, we care deeply about working conditions of everybody in the Apple family, and to say otherwise is just, you know, not true. While all the companies selling phones use similar factories to make them, they can be involved at different levels. One could say that Apple could do more or HP could do more. They can opt to say, you know what, here is money, give us product and be hands off. Or they can opt to say, here is money, here are standards, give us product. Or they can opt to say, here are money, here are standards. And by the way, we are going to send surprise inspectors into your plant when you least expect it and make sure that you're up to our standards. It's a question of how much Apple wants to be involved in the manufacture of the products that they are paying for. And what people are saying is that Apple is not involved enough.
The New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof, who's written widely and impassionately about human rights issues around the world, has defended the labor conditions in China on occasion, saying that these have created employment opportunities and lifted living conditions in certain areas. Is that a widely held point of view?
Yeah, there is a very popular economic argument that goes that this is a stage that economies go through as they move from rural or agrarian to industrial and to service base like ours is, that in order to get to the dream of a middle class based economy, that you have to go through this manufacturing period where you're making a lot of stuff for cheap and lift people out of the subsistence living through factory employment, just like the Industrial Revolution did. I'm not an economist. I don't know if that is a necessary step. Certainly the scale of it and the way the global economy makes it, pushes these things along and drives down the prices that people are willing to pay for these products. I think the scale of that is just unprecedented right now.
We're talking about new reporting about labor practices in factories that help make consumer electronics, specifically popular Apple products, among others. Our guest is Rafe Needleman of the tech publication CNET. So now I'd like to hear your perspective on this. Do you think that tech companies could do more to improve the working conditions at these factories that make their products?
Theoretically, of course. Apple has an incredibly high profit margin. They could take some of those profits and funnel them back into improving working conditions. It's not a simple problem to solve, however. Even if they say we want people who are working on our products to live in better conditions, to be paid more, they then have to enforce that through their suppliers. And one of the problems that Apple has is that it is so big and it is making so many products that there are very, very few companies that can provide what Apple wants at the scale that Apple wants it. So Apple can't go to Foxconn, its biggest supplier of iPhones, and say, you know what, you guys aren't living up to our expectations. We're going to find somebody else. There is nobody else. So it's a very difficult dance.
Well, why, though? Is it that the labor practices in China are at a level where the company would not be responsive? I mean, one has to assume that if Apple is They're one of Apple's biggest suppliers, that they would have an interest in being responsive. So why wouldn't they be responsive? Because nobody's telling them that they have to, or because that's considered the norm in China? So therefore, what's the incentive to change?
I'm sure the answer is simply economic. While Apple is making 30% margins on its phones, that doesn't mean that Foxconn is. These are unbelievably complicated and advanced electronic devices being made primarily by hand because they were designed to be made by hand. And the whole product is built around these plants. So for Apple to go to Foxconn and say, make the plants more habitable for their workers, Foxconn then has to take this argument with Apple at a remove and say, how are we going to make as much money as we have been before? How are we going to employ all these people? How are we going to continue to pay them? How are we going to keep our margins up? And Apple pushes Foxconn's margins way down.
After the publication of these reports, online petitions urging Apple to make an ethical iPhone have circulated the web. One, last time I checked, has more than 175,000 signatures. This was on a petition by change.org. Is there any precedent for this kind of consumer response to result in changes to manufacturing processes, for example?
There is. Nike is a good example of this. It was uncovered that Nike shoes were being made in rather deplorable working conditions for the most part. And whether or not public outcry caused Nike to change or Nike just realized what was happening, that did begin to change. And now Nike grades its plants both on working conditions and on environmental conditions. And arguably, they have improved because people didn't want to be wearing human rights violations on their feet. And there are some parallels. And consumers who get up in arms about something, who say, you know what, I'll pay $50 more for an iPhone that is made without breaking the back of somebody, that could make a difference.
Any sign that it is making a difference?
Well, Tim Cook's response after weeks of withering reports about and the popularity of this American Life episode with Mike Daisy does show that Apple is taking it very seriously.
Recently, in the President's State of the Union address, he called upon American companies to bring some of these jobs back home. Mm-hmm. And I am wondering whether there is any discussion about that.
Well, as Charles Duhigg reported in the Times, he doesn't think these products will ever be made in the United States because we don't have the know-how to make them, and the products are not designed to be made in our types of factories. However, if you look at what's happening, what happened historically in automobile manufacture, we do know in this country how to make incredibly complex products that have very long and convoluted supply chains that employ a lot of people. We can design products to be manufactured by American workers. It's a question of how much Apple wants to pay. It's a question of, you know, if you own Apple stock, you're very happy with Apple right now. Apple stock is phenomenal. It's the most valuable company, publicly traded company that we have. And that is because it is managed ruthlessly, and I say that in, from the economic perspective, to be incredibly profitable. If we want Apple to be a company that funnels more of the manufacturing dollars back into the United States, we can have it. Apple can do it. It's just a question of when and how much we're willing to pay for that.
Rafe Needleman is editor at CNET. He's also host of the Reporters Roundtable for CNET, and he was kind enough to join us from their studios in San Francisco. Rafe Needleman, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you.
And now to matters of personal finance. If you are considering higher education this fall, or one of your children is, now is the time to figure out how to pay for it. One popular way is to try to get financial aid, whether grants or scholarships or student loans. But what you might not know is that deadlines are coming up as early as March in some states. But a lot of students find the process confusing and intimidating. Recently, U.S. Representative Loretta Sanchez, a Democrat of California, hosted a series of seminars on financial aid for her constituents. One group that participated was called Gear Up. That's a program to help low-income students get into higher education. To tell us more about that program, we've called upon Adriana Badillo. She is the director of Gear Up at California State University at Fullerton. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
And Gear Up means?
Gaining Early Awareness and Readiness for Undergraduate Programs.
And that's a national program funded by the Department of Education. Do I have that right?
That's correct.
Tell us a little bit more about the program, if you would.
It's a program to help underserved students to continue their education into post-secondary institutions. So we help them all the way from junior high through our middle school through high school and making sure that they know the information or what steps they need to take so they can apply, enroll, and succeed in an institution of post-secondary education.
Well, you know, you have to assume that a lot of the kids who would, young people, or even perhaps not so young people who are participating in a program like this are probably first-time college attendees. Their parents probably didn't go to college. And you can see where this could be very intimidating. But what are some of the fears, concerns that a lot of the students you work with bring to this process?
I think more than fear is just a lack of knowledge of what steps they need to take. So they don't know where to start. So the goal of Gear Up is to kind of educate them on that regard and find out what is it that we can help them with and get into that transition and get them started.
But what are some of the things that many of these students and families most need to know? I mean, the deadlines obviously is one, but what are the others?
I think what with this population is getting them over that fear that they might not qualify. We are in a very diverse community, even though predominantly most of the students that we work with are Latino. Sometimes, you know, we make the assumptions that we will not going to qualify for that free aid. You know, a lot of the students that we're serving, a lot of them are homeless as well. And you don't want their classmates to know that they don't have a mailing address or a home address. So a lot of the things that our families are going through, they would have to, you know, if they're in a workshop, they feel they might have to say it out loud. For example, a lot of things I've been dealing more closely now when we're helping them with financial aid is, what if my parents file for bankruptcy, or what if we're losing our home? So a lot of the times we just want to make sure that they know that, you know, we can help them. We don't have to advertise what their financial situation is. And I think that's a lot of what we try to do in our job. We work with a lot of students that are immigrants. So maybe their mom or their dad don't have a Social Security. They're not U.S. nationals. So the families don't want to ask anything from them. Or maybe they're in process to getting their green card, or they're just waiting to get their green card. And they don't want to ask for money in fear that they might be removed from the process, or that it will go, you know, against them when they go to their meeting for the Homeland Security. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of issues that we deal with, especially with immigrant families or, you know, or low-income students that I think you also deal with in the general population, but there's other very specific issues that we have to almost comfort them and letting them know that it's okay, we'll work with them. And some of them are a case-by-case scenario.
I'm speaking with Adriana Badillo. She is the director of Gear Up at California State University Fullerton. That's a program to help low-income students get into higher education programs. She helps teach kids how to get financial aid. What is the one form that everybody should fill out? Isn't there a one sort of central form that everybody should fill? What is that?
That's the Free Application for Federal Student Aid, or also known as FAFSA.
FAFSA. So that's a term if you're in this area, you're going to hear the term FAFSA a lot. Tell me a little bit about this.
It's a free form through the federal government where students apply and see what their expected family contribution is, or EFC. And what it is they take into account your latest income information for the prior year, and then what institutions of higher learning you're applying to and what resources a family has. And then they give you a number to what is it you might qualify for. No one else is going to give you that free money if you don't invest that, you know, hour or two in the weekend to fill it out. So it's, you're not going to lose anything by applying and finding out whether you do or not qualify for that free money.
And when you use the word free, now this is another question I think a lot of people have. Mm-hmm. In recent years, particularly I think related to the mortgage crisis, many people have become acquainted with the idea that there are scams out there. Are there obvious red flags that you want to point out?
Yes, some obvious. There are businesses out there that charge for them to fill out the free application. So we always caution parents and students to be wary of those firms or those companies or those individuals that are charging to do a free process. So making sure that they go to the right website, you know, FAFSA, FAFSA.ed.gov.
.gov is a sign. The .gov means it's something that's run by the government and not by a private corporation, and that should be free. And you're saying if somebody's wanting to charge you money to fill out a form, watch out.
Watch out. Or watch out for someone that might send you a letter home telling you if you come to the seminar, this weekend seminar, if you pay us $100, we guarantee you financial aid. They shouldn't guarantee that.
You're saying that there's no guarantee. There's no magic bullet. There's no magic wand.
There's no magic wand. In the terms of the free application for federal student aid, the federal government has its own formulas that they take into consideration. No one has those formulas, only them. So the family has to apply and find out what they're expected to contribute for the students' higher education expenses.
Okay, is there one piece of advice that you wish you had had before you started this process? I know you're an expert now, but back when you were new at this, is there something you really wish somebody had told you?
Don't be intimidated, and there's always a lot of people willing to help. You just got to look out for that help. You know, you're a high school counselor, are your best bet. And for example, in my case, I didn't go enough to my high school counselor. And sometimes, you know, they're really busy with a lot of students, but making sure that they go out and ask for help, it's the key factor here, because it is an intimidating process. But there's also just as many people trying to help them out. So asking for that help is the first step.
Adriana Badillo is director of Gear Up at California State University Fullerton. She was kind enough to join us from Costa Mesa, California. Adriana, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Just ahead, working moms have all kinds of challenges. They juggle the tensions and trials of a workday with band practice, baseball games, having dinner on the table, and homework. And a new study points out that there's another challenge on that list. Mothers tend to earn less than other working women, especially in certain fields. We've got some thoughts on that from our panel of moms. That's just ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. They say it takes a village to raise a child, but maybe you just need a few moms in your corner. Every week, we check in with a diverse group of parents for their common sense and savvy advice. This week, we want to talk about the wage gap. Now, you've probably heard about the persistent wage gap between men and women. The most recent census data shows that, on average, women make 77 cents to every dollar a man makes, and that gap has closed in recent decades, but it still persists. But now, researchers have also found a wage gap between moms and other working women. Women who have children now earn 7% to 14% less than women who do not have children. That's according to economist Kate Krause of the University of New Mexico. And she identifies a number of possible explanations for this phenomenon, and we want to hear her perspective on why this is. But we also want to figure out if there's something that women who are mothers or want to be mothers can do about this if they want to. So to have the conversation, I'm joined now by Kate Krause. She's a professor of economics at the University of New Mexico, as we said. She's co-author of the research we just mentioned. She's also the mother of two daughters. Dina Baxt is co-founder and co-president of A Better Balance. That's an organization that advocates for working families. She's the mom of three daughters. Also with us, Dawn Porter. She's a former television executive, and she's founder of Trilogy Films, and she has two sons. Welcome, ladies, moms. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Professor Krause, I'm going to start with you. Now, you researched this gap between mothers and other working women. Every mother works. We get that. But we're talking about women who earn a wage. And I'd like to ask you, now, this is the proverbial sort of chicken and egg question that everybody asks here. Is this a result of discrimination, that women with children are sort of viewed in a different light, given less favorable assignments, just for whatever reason that employers say, well, you're just not getting that check? Or is it a self-selection process that once women have children, or women who want to have children, self-select and put themselves into less remunerative jobs? So which is it?
So that's a great question. It sounds like you might have been a research assistant on this project. I do want to say this is not at all a new phenomenon or a new finding. We followed in the footsteps of many people who have investigated differential wages by a lot of different characteristics, right? We think about wage gaps between men and women, between, across race and ethnicity. But the mom gap was a particularly troubling thing. My co-authors and I do what we call me search. We research things about ourselves, and we all had children, so we researched that. And actually, the gap that you mentioned is an aggregate gap. At the beginning of the show, you gave quite large numbers, like in the teens. But if you drill down and control for factors that can help to explain the things that you were talking about, selection into different careers, you can reduce what we like to do as economists, say, I can explain some of that gap by voluntary steps that women might take. I might take a less demanding job if it gives me more time with my children in exchange for a lower wage, or in anticipation of having children, I might get less college education, because why get it if I'm going to stay home with the kids? So we have these sort of explanations that on the surface make a lot of sense for differential wages.
Okay, so help me out here. Which is it? Is it all of the above? Is it all those
things?
It's all of those things. Okay.
All of the above and then some.
And then some.
So if you look at just differences in education and differences in occupation, but I'm going to have to circle back to that. Let's just say differences in education and other sort of neutral kind of decisions you might make. That explains about half the gap. If you look at timing of return, did I come back right away or did I wait until my kids were in school? That explains a big part of the gap, right? I've lost some experience. I've lost some momentum maybe. But if I can think about all of those things and control for them in a statistical way, and I still see a gap, then I'm going to be really nervous. Then I'm going to say, boy, I can't explain that with all of these things. A mom who does everything exactly the same as someone who hasn't had children, if there's still a gap, how do I explain that? And that, to an economist, is the fun of the research, is discovering things I can't explain.
Okay. So, Dina, you're an attorney, and you were formerly with the now Legal Defense and Education Fund. Now it's Legal Momentum. So, as I understand it, you believe that a lot of it's discrimination.
Certainly a large part of it. You know, it's a loaded question, and there are other factors that people may point to, but the reality is that discrimination is still very much at play in the workplace. And A Better Balance runs a free legal clinic. And we see it really firsthand.
Tell me how it works. That's kind of the thing I'm interested in, how it works. Because, you know, it used to be that the newspaper would say, just like it would say, you know, these are jobs for white people and nobody else need apply. Jobs also used to say these are jobs for men or for women. That's not permitted anymore. So how do you think it works? You think it's kind of more of an unconscious response to women becoming mothers that employers say, oh, you just can't handle this assignment? Or, oh, what? What do you think it is?
Well, there's still blatant discrimination against new mothers out there. I mean, you would be shocked what we hear when pregnant women announce their pregnancies and are told, or what are we going to do about that? I mean, that is still out there alive and well. But of course, there's much more subtle stereotyping about new mothers' competence and commitment that's going on in the workplace. You know, we often see women returning from maternity leave who are given less work or dead-end assignments. And this type of discrimination really drags down wages for women because they get off track and even worse, often pushed out of the workforce. And then we also hear about women who work part-time who are really face a documented wage and benefit penalty. The penalties associated with part-time work in the U.S. are actually 7 times higher as they are in Sweden and the U.K. And this affects workers across the economic spectrum, but we see low-wage workers especially hard hit with little if no benefits and with pretty much no with documented wage penalties.
Don Porter, let's turn to you, that you are also an attorney, but you had a long career in television. You worked on things like standards and practices, for example, you know, making sure that, you know, requirements that the content didn't, you know, cross certain sort of boundaries and so forth like that. You know, television is notorious for demanding hours and work assignments. And I just wanted to ask how your experience, and I should mention, we were former colleagues at the same network. So I'd like to ask, you know, what is your take on this research? Did you feel that the way you were treated in the workplace or in different places changed after you became a mother?
Well, I definitely think, you know, one of the things that we should talk about is the idea of role models in the workplace. And as we have fewer women with children in the workplace, young women in particular have fewer women to look to even know what to ask for. So in one sense, I was extremely fortunate. I had a really supportive boss who helped me figure out how to have a job share. On the other hand, there's only so much she could do, right? If you're in a demanding career, the reality is to get ahead, to get those stretch assignments, there is a perception that a person who has children or a person who wants to leave, goodness forbid, you want to leave the office at 5 o'clock, which we never did. We never left at 5 o'clock. But if you wanted to leave at 5, you're viewed as less committed. And I think that is, you know, a real drag something that hurts particularly new mothers who are trying to figure out how to balance motherhood with their desire to be outstanding workers.
We're talking about the wage gap between mothers and other women in the paid workforce. Research shows that moms make less than women without children. And we're talking about why that might be. And now I'd like to turn to, are there things that people, mothers, women who want to be mothers, can do about this? And I'm joined by former television executive Dawn Porter. She is also an attorney, and she's now started her own business. Dina Baxt is with the organization A Better Balance. And Kate Krause is an economics professor at the University of New Mexico who's researched this question. So, Dawn, I think, I'm sorry, look, you've raised a sensitive question, but we need to address it. What about the whole, you know, commitment issue? I'll just put myself into it. I'll just thank Jackie Leiden for sitting in for me yesterday. I had a medical issue involving one of my children and that had to be attended to urgently. Now, could I have asked the babysitter to take her? I could have. I felt I am her mother. I need to be there. You can see a scenario where somebody might say, you're just not as committed as a male host who would say, delegate that task to somebody else. Now, Kate, I'm going to go to you on this because you make the argument that the same behavior is viewed differently when men and women engage in it. Can you pick up on that point?
Yeah, actually, that's a really good point. It's not something that was part of our like really formal research agenda, but it was certainly something that we saw. So, like your other guests, I also practiced law too. I quit when I had kids because I couldn't commit to that. So I'm sort of guilty of, you know, being the stereotype. Our department in economics moved from a very male-dominated department when I first joined it to one with a lot of other moms. But it's completely different when a mom says, I got to go coach soccer. That's, oh, yeah, right. And if a dad says, I have to go coach soccer, it's, oh, wow, you are a great dad. And I think that it's because it's one thing is really valued, like you're breaking this norm and being this great dad. And maybe it's the sort of cultural norm expectations clash that catches women in this double bind where they want to show commitment and yet show commitment to work, but also, of course, your family. I mean, that's clearly important.
Well, Dawn, I don't know. What do you think about that? Because you remember that the Ted Koppel, you know, one of my favorite anchors of all time, of course, a colleague of mine at Nightline, he was the anchor of the program I worked at there, wrote about in his autobiography or his memoir about how when he arranged his schedule to anchor on the weekend so that his wife could go to law school, he felt he was penalized for it at work. He was looked down upon as not being, you know, a macho tough guy, when here is a guy who's a famous war correspondent before he took that job. So, Dawn, I mean, Dawn, what's your sense of that? Well, is that a male-female piece, or is it a caregiver piece, that caregivers are penalized in the workplace?
You know, I think we're seeing more and more that men and women would like more family-friendly, child-friendly workplace situations. And I think what's happened, though, is we have to figure out how to change the dialogue around that. I became no less committed to my job because I had something that I was equally committed to, which were my children. I do think there's a big difference between, you know, if you look at the time when young women are having children, it is a very sensitive time in their careers. It is when they're in their late 20s, 30s. That's the time when the employers are really looking to who are our superstars, right? Who are we going to bet the farm on? And if you look like you have a commitment to anything other than getting ahead and making your workplace number one, you know, I think there often is some hesitancy in giving you the plum assignments, and that affects women more, I think, than it does affect men.
So what should be done about this? What can people do about this? Let's fix this thing right now. I just want to mention that Working Mother magazine wrote about this, and Kate, they also talked about some of your research too. And one of the things that they talked about was prove yourself first. Try to make yourself invaluable before you have children. Come back when you're ready, they say, because there's no magic time. You're going to take the hit, so just get the hit over with. And they also say certain professions penalize women a lot, and others are relatively forgiving. For example, for some reason, law, women with MBAs saw their pay drop dramatically, but by contrast, women doctors across many specialties did not take as large of a hit, which is interesting. So, Dina, what's your take on this based on all these things that you've seen in the real world, in the workforce? What are there things that women can do to minimize this?
Well, there are certainly individual steps that people can take, but I think we need to look more broadly here and look what our public policies can do to catch up with the realities of the modern workforce. I think, first of all, we need to head on address unfair pay in the workplace and strengthen our equal pay laws. There's still a blanket of secrecy around pay in this country, and workers are penalized for sharing salary information. And, you know, we can't enforce our equal pay laws in a vacuum. So that's critically important that we open up and people can understand if they're being paid fairly or not. Second of all, I think we need to focus on making supportive work-family policies a priority, because those are key to keeping women on track, and that will play a role in helping to narrow the wage gap. And a recent study out of Rutgers, which was commissioned by the National Partnership for Women and Families, shows that paid family leave increases wages for women and increases their attachment to the labor force. And we need to really focus on policies and not just on individual, which careers individual women can choose. And we need to vigorously combat the type of discrimination I was talking about earlier. And get away from this choice conversation, because really we have structural problems in our workplace. Joan Williams calls it the ideal worker model, and it gives a leg up to workers with no family commitments. And anyone who deviates from this model pays a hefty price. And, this shouldn't be the case. And frankly, really, while higher income workers may have a choice to go to their kid's soccer game, we really need to frame this and also see how this affects middle and lower wage workers who don't have this choice or can't delegate it, and they take a day off to care for their sick child and they lose their jobs.
Sure. We've talked a lot about this. Let's talk about, police work, for example, where somebody, the police chief, calls a crime emergency and cancels all leave. Well, okay. People think prepaid vacation to Hawaii, but what about if you had taken time off or had planned to take time off to go to parent-teacher conferences or other really important parenting obligations? What do you do then when you're going on a 12-hour shift? So, Don, we only have a minute left. I'm going to give you the final word, because your TV experience will help you bring it home briefly. Anything you can do?
I think it's really important for the women to be talking to each other and to remember that this phase of your career is short. It's temporary. It's really a few years when, the balance, the work-life balance is really the toughest. And once you are a supervisor level, you do get more flexibility. So if you're in a career that you want to stay in, communicate with your supervisors, communicate with your coworkers. Try and offer proactive situations and communicate that you're trying to stay in this job, that you care about this job, just as much. And I think that's okay to say, as you do about your family responsibilities. So, don't self-select yourself out without making a real run for it if it's the job you want to stay in.
Dawn Porter is a former television executive and an attorney. She's founder of Trilogy Films. She was with us from member station WBGO in Newark, New Jersey. Also with us, Dina Bax. She's co-founder and co-president of an organization called A Better Balance. She's also an attorney. She was with us from NPR New York. Kate Krause is a professor of economics at the University of New Mexico. She's also an attorney. I don't know how we wound up with three attorneys in this conversation. She was with us from member station KUNM on that school's campus. Ladies, thank you all so much.
Thanks for having this conversation.
Thank you.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.